Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Vox Pop WMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. On today's show, it is the Copyright Forum. Many of you love this show. I don't know why, but you do. To answer your questions, I have our wonderful, great panel in the studio. Paul Rapp specializes in intellectual property law, including copyright, trademark, internet, art, and entertainment matters. He's also an adjunct professor of copyright and art and entertainment law at the Albany Law School. Bill Westwood, one of my favorite people in the world, is one of the country's leading medical illustrators, if not the leading medical illustrator, and a professional member and past president of the Association of, what else, Medical Illustrators. Also joining us today is Nagesh Rao, an IP lawyer and technology strategist. Nagesh is a former patent examiner and senior policy advisor to the U.S. Department of Commerce's Office of Innovation and Entrepreneurship. Now listen to me. This is why it's so great that you get them today, because a lot of people call up and have patent questions in the past.
Yep.
And we've always said, we don't know, that's not my kind of law, says, Paul. And so today we have, is it pronounced Nagesh?
No, it's Nagesh.
Nagesh. Nagesh. Well, that's close. Nagesh.
But,
Nagesh. It's close. Yeah. Give us a call at 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. I also have to read to you that you can tweet your question.
Wow.
Yes, at WAMC Vox Pop, or comment on our Facebook page, facebook.com/WAMC Radio. Well, gentlemen, thanks very much for being here, and appreciate it. You guys are always terrific. There is always somebody. And we're at low power today because the state police are making a fix on their antenna on top of the tower, the big tower on top of Mount Greylock.
Ah.
We have to respect the law, and I have to go home without getting a ticket. So I'm not saying anything, if you know what I mean. 1-800-348-2551. Let's talk to Manny. All right, Manny. You're one smart guy to get in early, Manny. Go ahead.
Hello, guys. Alan, you've been doing a great job, and you're indefatigable, if that's a word.
But?
Indefatigable?
No. Then you say you're doing a great job. I'm always waiting for the but. You're doing
there
a great
is no
job,
but, my friend. Okay. You do a wonderful job.
Okay, Manny, go ahead.
Okay, the question I have is that I had a patent that I have, I think it was over 17 years ago. They always ask me for maintenance fees and stuff like that, and I haven't been paying those maintenance fees. Is my patent still in effect, number one? And number two, what is the story with recorded music? Because I have a lot of music recorded, and what kind of copyright protection can I get with that?
Okay, so the copyright question goes to Paul.
Yeah.
And Nagesh?
Yes, I can answer that.
How fortunate we have a patent guy in here. You know, this is great.
So, this is fantastic. let me put a little bit of a prologue so you guys know in the area. I'm actually an Albany native, born in Troy. So I came from the area, went to RPI undergrad, and got my master's in patent law under Paul Rapp's tutelage.
Well, I would have spotted you as an Albanian the moment I saw you.
Yes, it was the nose, right? So I spent the last 7 years in D.C. working with the U.S. Department of Commerce and the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. So I definitely know the answer to your question, Manny. To get right to the answer real quick, if it's from 17 years ago and you haven't paid the maintenance fees, it's no longer enforceable. You have to pay those maintenance fees. It's considered abandoned. So you have the lifespan of a patent, if it's from 17 years ago, is probably going to be, I think it's like 17 years from the date of issuance, around there, 17 to 18 years. Around early 2000s, I forgot the exact date, it went 20 years from the date of filing. Either way, when you lapse on your paying of the maintenance fees, you've effectively have abandoned your rights to the patent. However, if you make up the payment of those maintenance fees and all the due interest and whatnot, and there are ways to do it with the PTO, you can then make it, you can revive it in order to make it back into enforcement.
Well, but that's the good news, right? Good news is he's not.
It's probably not from the sounds of it, from what I've heard, it probably has already expired.
And how long can a patent be in effect?
Patents nowadays are 20 years from the date of filing.
Okay.
Yours, it sounded like, was pre-change. They did some changes back in the early 2000s, but yours was probably 17 years. I think it was 17, 18 years.
Like 93 is what
Yeah, so if it was from 93, it was probably 17 years from date of issuance.
So it's probably dead.
So it's expired
it's already expired.
Even if you paid the maintenance fees, yeah, it would just be. Yeah.
Exactly.
Just reapply then.
No. Well, for that patent, if you reapply, you have to have a new useful improvement. So if you were to apply with that same piece of technology and make those same claims, you would be rejected based on the fact that you've already been awarded a patent.
Right.
So really, you are what we call in the business SOOL, S-O-O-L. S-O-O-L.
Here's my opinion on you shortly.
And you asked about recorded music, and that's a matter of copyright. Recorded music will have two copyrights. One is for the composition, and the other is for the recorded performance of the composition, and you can register those with the U.S. Copyright Office, which is part of the Library of Congress.
And so you can just send them the tape and it's registered.
Yeah, and you can actually, if it hasn't been published, if you haven't released it and sold multiple copies out to the public, you can do it all online, and you can do it all with one application, and you can go to their website at copyright.gov and find out.
So, Manny, you've had your share.
Yes, I did, and thank you so much, guys.
You're welcome. Thanks a lot.
Okay, bye-bye.
And now we go to Ken in Saratoga Springs. All right, here we go to Ken. Ken, you're on.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hello. Hey.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm on the road. I have a question about audio tapes. I made audio tapes of the hours right after President Kennedy's assassination. I took them off the air, and I followed through right up and through the burial, through the ceremonies in Washington. I tried to put these up for sale on eBay, and they refused to put them on. I was wondering, was there a copyright problem?
Yeah, I think there probably was a copyright problem, although it was prior to 78, Paul. But I assume those copyrights belong to the whatever broadcasting entities that... That were broadcasting them, so that would limit your ability to protect those. And it, but
well, I don't know. I guess he was trying to protect it. He was trying to sell it.
But I understand that. Yeah. But the reason they wouldn't do it is because they were protected. And,
right.
And,
oh, I see.
Yeah, and especially if you're making copies, if you're reproducing these and selling. Selling them, that's really going to be an issue. Selling the single copy that you have would be less so, but I could see why eBay would sort of reject that out of hand. eBay gets nailed all the time and wrongly, really, for handling work that might be infringing people's trademarks and copyrights.
When you say nailed, what do you mean nailed?
They get sued. All over the world. By companies trying to protect their brands, and so they are on the lookout, and they are a little bit proactive about what it is they're handling in order to avoid that. And something like that, it would just raise all kinds of red flags.
So what's the difference, guys, between aggregators, you know, these people who just take everybody else's work and get rid of it, and what Ken is doing? They lead you to other people's websites. Is that what this is all the aggregators do? And whereas Ken would be using the work as his own,
I think that would be that would be the difference. Because and aggregators, if they only take a little bit, like Huffington Post or our friend Seth, if they only take a little bit and you click on it and you go to the website, you're really actually helping the originator by going driving traffic
to the
website.
And by the way, while we're on the subject, I'm sorry, Ken, I just want to deviate for a second.
Okay.
I think that the aggregators may soon be S-O-O-L too, because that's out of luck, or the last three words. Mm-hmm. Because there are so many paywalls going up in newspapers now, so if you're aggregating, it may be more difficult to do that.
It will be if there's paywalls. Although most paywalls have a, like the New York Times, you get so many hits for free.
10 hits.
Yeah, and then you've got to pay. So, but it definitely makes it more difficult. And I've got several clients who are, you know, aggregators who are watching all this very closely. You know?
There are also many other types of aggregators in the publishing industry. There are aggregators that are collecting, for example, all the journal articles, and. You know, a lot of us are trying to resist having our work go to aggregators.
I don't blame you a bit.
But because once it gets to an aggregator, you can't control where it's going to go from there.
So hey, I've got a different quick... You're the political science expert.
Indeed, I am.
So I'm just wondering, just out of... Would have also been an issue of maybe political sensitivity, the subject sensitivity, because it is a collection
The original
of,
question.
A collection of data... regarding the death of a president, a very popular president?
Well, that's interesting. No, I doubt it. I suspect it has to do more
with the copyright issues.
More with the idea that, as the guys have said, we don't want to get sued. Yeah. That's probably it. Hey, Ken, thank you. You've had your turn.
Yeah, so what you're saying is if I sold them, that may not be such a big deal, but the buyer may copy them and try to distribute them, and that would infringe on the radio stations.
No, I don't think that's what they were saying. They were saying since you were offering multiple copies,
I'm only offering one copy.
Huh.
The original copy.
That's interesting.
Huh. That is interesting, and you wonder if that stuff is, you know, out there on archive.org or in the Smithsonian or you know.
But I think it's what you said, Paul. I think they're just gun shy.
Yeah.
And they're looking at it, somebody saying, no, this is not Ken's original material. This is material that's collected off of, that's been owned by someone else,
right,
or it is owned by someone else, and therefore they just aren't going to take the chance.
Well, it's so interesting because you watch YouTube and you see everybody's material.
Yeah,
YouTube.
You could post this stuff on YouTube or on archive.org, or you know, if you just wanted it to disseminate it, and you probably nobody would say boo, because these are 40-year-old and they are of historical value.
Ken, I wish I could give you more. I wish I could give you more time. I cannot. We're up against the break, and I thank you very much for your wonderful call. Engendered a lot of talk. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Okay, we'll take a break. We'll be right back.
Support for WAMC comes from SPAC, presenting the Buffalo Philharmonic Orchestra July 25th with conductor Joanne Paletta and Michael Ludwig Violin performing Smetana, Mozart, and Dvorak, sponsored by First Niagara, SPAC.org. Kern Compliance Services, LLC, Greenwich, New York, providing legal and consulting services to life insurers in a changing regulatory climate. KernCompliance.com. Hildene, the Lincoln Family Home, Manchester, Vermont. Historic home, Pullman car, museum store, and walking trails open daily year-round, 9:30 to 4:30, hildene.org. Fleet Feet Sports, Colony, New York. Footwear and apparel for runners, walkers, and triathletes, offering coached training programs for all distances, all abilities, fleetfeetalbany.com. And Albany IVF, Albany, offering reproductive services through education, medical technology, and lifestyle consultations, albanyivf.com.
And we are back with our wonderful panel. We appreciate so much everybody being with us. And here we go to the weekly question on T-shirts from John in Newburgh. John in Newburgh, ask the T-shirt question.
Yes, good afternoon, everyone. Mine is a basic question as it goes here. I created a design that I'd like to put on a T-shirt. And ultimately, I'd like to market that T-shirt to the catalogers. But the question is what is the best way to protect that design?
Well, I mean,
so this copyright.
Well, Paul will say copyright. I will say it also. You have the option of trademark if it's given the particulars of the design, and also possibly a design patent based on the look and feel of it. Those are a couple of other options you could play with, but copyright's probably the one that's most effective.
Well, it depends on the design, too. Is it illustrative in nature, or is it graphic design in nature?
Is it like a smiley face?
It's a combination of words. It's basically a lot of words and maybe some graphic.
Probably copyright.
Yeah, probably. And copyright's the cheapest and the quickest to get. The question we get a lot is, you know, you have a short phrase and you put it on a on a copyright. And I have tried to get copyrights for those, and they're rejected simply because short phrases are not allowed in copyright protection. But you know, if there's enough words there and you have enough design elements to it, I would copyright it. And then you know.
Remind, before we start, just remind everybody how you get a copyright.
You get a copyright, and actually, we've probably just described the difference between copyright, trademark, and patent while we're at it. You get a copyright by registering. Well, you actually get a copyright automatically by creating something, and then to get more protection, you register it with the Copyright Office at copyright.gov. Copyright protects original works of creativity, music, art, literary works, film. Trademark protects designations of source, like logos and the name of your company, and anything else that designates you as the source of a good or service. And patent covers purely functional.
Utilitarian
inventions, apparatuses, products, compositions of matter.
Okay.
So it sounds to me basically I should go copyright at the copyright.gov site.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
Right.
All right. Thank you.
John, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Okay. 1-800-348-2551. And we go to Paul in Albany. All right. Paul in Albany, you're on.
Yes. Hi. Thank you. Brad, you already answered my question. I have a couple of short phrases that I think would be suitable for a bumper sticker. I wasn't thinking T-shirts, but I guess you said that there is a limit of what would be considered copyrightable based on the length. Is there an exact guideline, or is it a judgment call, I guess?
It's really a judgment call. They just say short phrases.
Words and short phrases are not protected under copyright law.
You know, right. And what I've done sometimes with people with a short phrase is I'll get a trademark for it.
Yep.
But the thing is, you have to name the name of your company has to be that short phrase. And so if you've got a number of short phrases, you know, then all of a sudden you're forming a number of companies, you know, each one to market the short phrase, and it can get really cumbersome really fast. But, you know, if you've got a short phrase that's hot, then, you know, why not?
There was Linsanity. Justin Lin got the trademark for Linsanity. So,
right.
Is that right?
Yeah, he got it. They gave it to him.
So it would be better to try and trademark it than copyright it, you're saying?
I think
yes.
So, yeah.
This is Nagesh speaking. Yes, I would say so. In fact, I did one for some of the guys out in Silicon Valley recently for a box wine idea. And so the term box wine, BAUXWINE, it just was much more suitable for a trademark, and he got it.
Huh, even though you're not, like, creating a company or anything.
Well, he's actually creating a box wine company.
Yeah, you're going to have
as a result of it. But the whole idea is he trademarked that term, and so it's the use of the term. So Coca-Cola, that's a trademark, and it's also the name for the company for, you know, Coca-Cola beverages and whatnot. But it's the use of the terminology that defines how it's going to be protected from an intellectual property standpoint.
But also keep in mind, you have to use that. You can't just put it out there and not use it, because
yes,
it can become invalidated that way.
It is, yeah. That is correct. You have to, for the first 5 years or 10 years, you have to use it in a manner that's afforded by the trademark statutes.
No, that's interesting. Let me ask you something, because you guys keep saying protect it, protect it, protect it. So there's some guy who takes our trademark here at WMC.
Mm-hmm.
And he uses it with impunity. I believe he hasn't got any money. I believe he, you know, just does it. How many people really get around to suing based on the fact that somebody is, you know, especially in the age of internet, is because it costs a lot of money to sue somebody?
Cease and desist letters are just a hassle right now. The oatmeal situation I don't know if you guys heard about the oatmeal thing.
No, I haven't.
Paul, you want to talk a little? It's more up your alley.
Yeah, and I've been busy, so I haven't been following it closely, but a comedy site accused another comedy site of stealing a lot of their bits, their internet bits, without giving credit. And the site that was, you know, accused of stealing basically went crazy and had their lawyer send this blazing cease and desist letter to the oatmeal site, which is the site that was doing the accusing.
The victim is being sued by the
never fails.
And,
yeah.
and demanding $20,000. And so Oatmeal said, we're not going to give you $20,000, but we're going to raise $20,000 and give it to charity. So far, Oatmeal has raised something like $200,000.
Yep. Wow.
And they're giving out to, you know, the American Cancer Society and all the rest. And the site that was doing the infringing has now sued not only Oatmeal but all of the charities.
Yes. I mean, it's the lawyer himself, Charles Carrion, is suing. There was the National Wildlife Federation and the American Cancer Society. I think it was.
There's something wrong here, folks.
Yeah,
it's hilarious. Right. Bill Westwood, you're going to say something.
I've forgotten what it was. Yeah, doesn't matter.
You're going to tell us that you've sued somebody.
I was simply going to say, you ask who sued. I raised my hand.
Go to TechCrunch, people.
I'm
go
litigious.
To TechCrunch and read the whole Oatmeal.
Yeah, but
Matt,
I mean, everybody assumes
it's
every time that somebody's going to sue you or you're going to sue, but in fact, you go get a lawyer to start a lawsuit, you better have $100,000 in the bank, probably.
You got it. You got it.
I've been there, done that. It's very, very expensive.
Okay. Hey,
yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Hey, Steve, is that enough? Is that what I was talking about, Paul, I mean?
Quick follow-up question. So you say if trademark is a better way to go for a short phrase like this, and you said it has to be used, like, how would you, like, use it other than, like, you know, make more bumper stickers?
Well, that's it.
That's
it.
Yeah,
that's
you
fine.
Just use it on bumper stickers,
hey,
T-shirts,
Paul,
whatever.
You've had your chance. That's enough now. We'll talk to you later.
Thank you.
Let's get a Sprout Man in Great Barrington.
Sprout Man.
Hey, Sprout Man.
Hey. Gentlemen, how are you? Great to hear you. I had to call in because I just got an email, which I think is a scam, from China, telling me that someone is about to set up the Sprout Man website in China.
Yeah. Oh, that's wrong.
Have an opportunity to get in before the rest of them do.
That's wrong.
Yeah, I see those all the time from my trademark clients, and like you, Sprout Man, and they are exactly. I mean, they smell like a scam, and
it's a
they
scam.
Most certainly are a scam.
9 out of 10 times, or 99 out of 100 times, when you get anything, including on the web, including a notice from your bank or anything else asking you for a little bit more information, just get rid of it fast.
Yeah, and trademark stuff, especially, you know, anything official will go to your representative, your listed lawyer on the trademark site. And, you know, I tell my clients once they get a registered trademark, watch out, because you're going to get inundated with, you know, official looking, you know, the American Trademark Office, you know, which is a private company, you know, wanting you to send them money to monitor your trademark.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's all everything. It's all scam stuff.
It's amazing. These people stay up late.
And some of them do a beautiful looking job. It's hard to tell the difference unless
right?
you're really
yeah,
sorry.
It's a scam, Steve. I mean, I dealt with this with my buddies who are in the U.S. Commercial Service out in China. I was doing some business for the patent office there, too. And it's a lot of it is just. It's tricky stuff. It's not legit. I'm telling you right now.
Well, let me make one point. Steve Meyerowitz is the one and only and the greatest.
He's the best.
Sprout Man.
Yes, he is.
Thank you, Sprout Man. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Can I just ask one general question on the same topic? I mean, how does one protect themselves on an international basis? I mean, you can't trademark in every country, can you?
You can trademark in a lot of countries, but it does get real expensive. You know, real fast.
With the patents, you do a PCT application. With trademarks, you got to do individual. I mean, there's
the Madrid Protocol, which makes it easier. You have a one stop, but you still have to pay the fees at every country. In some countries, you do have to then, you know, hire a local attorney. There are some countries where you still have to do that. So it can get into, if you want global coverage for a trademark, you know, it can get into thousands and thousands of dollars. And then maintaining that over time is expensive.
Tell us about
you've got to be strategic with your emerging market stuff. I was doing some of this in L.A. For a startup company on clean tech stuff. And you have to be strategic with the emerging markets, the BRICS, the Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, as to where you're going to actually position yourself and you believe you're going to get your best return on investment for the intellectual property protection you're going for in those markets.
Hey, Steve,
you
got to
work
it.
With the locals.
You don't get any more time, Steve. You're done.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Let's go to Tommy in Neversink. Hiya, Tommy. Welcome back. Go ahead.
Hello. Can you copyright, say you're in a band and you do a guitar solo on a record and then it becomes a hit. The band breaks up later. Somebody, the singer goes on to form his own band. Can you copyright the guitar solo you did so it can't be played by the next band?
Well, I want to go first. First of all, you have to know something, Tommy, as I'm sure you do. All bands, law number one, all bands always break up.
Yes.
Now, that's right.
I know, I'm a musician.
So we'll go from there. Paul?
The answer would almost definitely be no. I have never heard of anyone doing that. And even if you could, you couldn't stop other people from playing it because there's a compulsory license. You know, once a copyrighted song or a copyrighted work is recorded and published, that anybody can record that as long as they pay a license fee to the songwriter. But you know, generally, you know, unless you've got a songwriting credit, you know, for the song, the solo was considered part of the song, and you know, all of the royalties and legal protections go to the listed songwriters.
Well, this was actually the band The Smiths. Yes, and Johnny Marr did co-write the songs. So would that include his solo?
I think it would. Yeah, it would be part of the recording. Whether it would be part of the composition, boy, that's an interesting question, and I don't know. Has Johnny Marr actually challenged the Smiths on this?
Well,
basis?
The thing is, I heard a recording of Morrissey doing it solo, and the guitar part was changed on YouTube, and everybody was complaining, and someone made the comment, "Well, the new guitarist isn't allowed to play the same guitar part Johnny Marr played."
Nah, he would be. Somebody told me they went and saw Iron Butterfly about 10 years ago, and the drummer did a different solo.
Okay.
And it's like, no, that's, talk about sacrilege.
Wow.
Okay, hey, Tommy, thank you for calling, as always. Appreciate it, yeah. Okay. 1-800-348-2551. We'll go to, Elizabeth in Saratoga. Okay. Is it Elizabeth?
Yes. Hi, I'm here.
Okay. How do you pronounce your name, your first name?
Elizabeth.
Elizabeth. Okay.
Oh. Yeah.
We got a little translation problem here. Go ahead.
My question is concerning the difference between provisional and utility patent. I know that the utility patent is something that you have to get eventually for a patent, but is there an advantage to doing research during the provisional patent time?
Yeah, so Elizabeth, this is Nagesh here, and I'm glad you asked this question. And just so you know, I've just recruited Paul also. I'm doing this whole webinar program with NSETU, the National Council on Entrepreneurial Tech Transfer, with the USPTO's Global Intellectual Property Academy over the next 6-7 months. We got one July 11th. We're going to be talking about provisional patents. The USPTO is going to be talking about the official position on provisional versus non-provisional. It's a whole webinar program we started over the past couple of months, and I'll make sure Dr. Chartok gets the link so he can send it out.
No. Do it now so that in case anybody's listening and they want to come to the center, because I'm not getting it and I'm not using it. Go ahead.
Okay, so the best way to do it, if you Google NSET2, NCET2.org, and then you look for Patents and the University Startup Innovation Ecosystem. Patents and the University Startup Innovation Ecosystem. It's a 7-month webinar program that we're doing with USPTO and the federal government's Technology Transfer Working Group as part of the Obama administration's on trying to advance the commercialization of technology transfer from the lab to marketplace. With respect to your question, the question is, patents, there's the utility, design, and plant patents. Those are the three types of patents you can get from the patent office. There's provisional or a non-provisional. It's a double-edged sword with provisional. Provisional just secures your line in the filing date for the priority effective filing date. Non-provisional is when you actually act upon the patent application and say, this is my invention, this is what I've claimed, this is what I'm going after. But you can use the non-provisional to convert from a provisional application in securing your priority date. But the material that is enabling the non-provisional to actually be enforced for giving you the patent has to be covered in the provisional application. The advantage of the provisional application, two things. One, you secure your line and filing date. Two, you also have an opportunity to work out the kinks. So if you got an idea but you're not sure if it's fully fleshed out, you're reduced to practice or proof of concept, you file the provisional application because you might be talking about it at conferences, or you might be talking about it in the lab or in public disclosure, trying to figure things out. But you want to protect yourself so that you can at least secure your line of priority with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office for filing purposes.
So with a provisional patent, you are somewhat protected.
You're protected, but it's just securing your line in the place. But it's $125.
Well, line in the place or the place in the line?
Sorry. You're securing your line. You're securing your place in line with filing at the USPTO.
Right.
at the end of the year.
1 year. You get 1 year. Actually, right. With the Patent Reform Act, AIA, I believe they're changing it to 2 years, but at some point. But right now, it's just 1 year still.
So during that period with the provisional patent, the idea is to really finesse your idea to prepare it for the eventual.
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay.
And by the way, while we're on the subject, and I have this wonderful patent expert with us, Nagesh, I guess the question I want to ask is, getting patents isn't very easy, is it?
No, it's not. I'll tell you right now, it is not easy. Me personally, being there for 7 years, and I covered a whole host of technologies from crystal growth to 3D printing.
You're the guy who couldn't turn people down, right?
I'm the one who said no. I had probably one of the lowest allowance rates in the office. I had one of the perfect records there too, but I probably allowed maybe about a third of the applications that came before me. Right. I was extremely tough.
But is it sometimes based on character? In other words, the personality or the character of the person who you happen to catch?
There is a little bit of that in the sense of like when the interaction between the patent examiner and the attorney, sure. But the truth is that no, it's did it meet the snuff test? Did they actually file an application that was novel, not obvious, and useful?
Well, if there's somebody else sitting in your chair that day because you had the sniffles, is it possible somebody who you would have turned down would get through?
No. I play it fair. Almost all my colleagues play it fair.
Well, who knows if the person who was sitting in your chair was going to play. Okay. Elizabeth, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
You're welcome.
You.
Okay.
Take care.
And let's go. No, we got to take a break. Zach is very angry behind the wall here. We'll take a short break. We'll be right back.
Support for WAMC comes from Ashokan Center, Olive Bridge, New York, presenting a jazz, swing, and blues dance party with Jay and Molly, Swingology, and Lindy Hop Heaven, June 23rd at 8, dinner at 6, ashokencenter.org. New York State Tobacco-Free Community Partners, working to reduce youth and adult smoking rates across the state and help save lives. New York State Tobacco-Free Community Partners at smokefreecapital.org. Dan Cafe and Deli, Saugerties, New York, serving breakfast and lunch with chef-created soups, salads, vegetarian options, and homemade desserts. Catering services available, thedancafeanddeli.com. Williams College, supporting a community of learning in the Berkshires with lectures, exhibitions, and events, williams.edu. And Brain Injury Association of Massachusetts, providing support, prevention, education, and advocacy for brain injury survivors and families, BIAMA.org.
And we are back, a wonderful panel. A little oversight, we didn't mention that our wonderful Polly Law wasn't with us this week. And we heard from her, and we'll hear from her lawyers. Anyway, anyway, Polly, we do miss you. Okay, let's go to Elaine in Walden. All right, Elaine, you're on.
Yes, hi. In the 1970s, well, actually, more currently, my son at 6 was very gifted artistically and came to the attention of one of the group of gifted teachers who ultimately published his work in a book with a sign. I had to sign a release. Then in the 70s, I was involved in a group of feminist artists, and I had lost touch with them, and all of a sudden, 2 years ago, they published a book, someone published a book about the group, and my picture was on the front cover. it wasn't bad. I mean, my body wasn't, but it was pretty. I just wondered if there was any rule broken, or should they have, got a hold of me because I was reachable to sign some sort of permission to have my picture on the front of a book.
When was the artwork created, or was it artwork or photography?
It was photography back in the 1970s, and it was a feminist art group. And it turned out, as time went on, they realized it was the first in the United States, and so it kind of became an icon of the movement. And then somebody wrote a book, and we used a lot of the 8mm footage and still shots.
Is it a picture of you alone, or is it you with other people?
No, me alone, dressed up as a Koopy doll, which was part of the thing we were exploring. It was all the different images that women have had to, become to people,
Well, there is there's a civil rights law in New York State that says they can't use your image for commercial purposes, and that would be, advertising without your permission. and that might apply here, although, you know, you do figure into the story, and so there's this, you know, are you talked about personally in the book?
I believe so. I know my name is, like front cover is my name inside the book. It happened in California, and we were at Fresno State University at the time and allowed to have our own feminist environment in an old abandoned army barracks type thing. So, you know, we did a lot of things because it wasn't acceptable that time for women to make art out of their own experience. So, you know, during that time, there was quite a bit of photography of all the different images of women, from Coopy Doll to an old widow black hag with a humpback, and both of those I dressed up to depict, and pictures taken.
Okay, Elaine, we really need to sort of wrap it up very quickly, guys. What do you think?
Well, I think so that people understand, the listeners understand.
Sure.
This was done around 1970. This was prior to the existing copyright law. With existing law, anything created like that is copyrighted and owned by the creator upon creation. But then, because it's a photograph, one would assume it would be owned by the photographer.
The photographer, yeah. So it's not, I don't think it's a copyright issue.
So I don't think it's a copyright issue, as Paul has said. I think it's going to be a privacy or right to publicity type issue.
Yeah, and I think since, you know, if this was a work of fiction and they just grabbed your picture and put it on the front of the book because it made an easier selling book, that would definitely be a violation. But since you're a subject of the book, and since, you know, what's pictured on the cover is what the book is at least in part around, I think that the writer's First Amendment rights, you know, to create this work probably would trump your privacy rights. But maybe not. I mean, I think it's a fairly close call here.
You wouldn't happen to be married to a copyright lawyer, would you, by any chance?
No, and I bear no ill will. It was just curiosity because
Well, no, the reason I ask is because then, now, let's say they had said to you, yeah, go get him, Tiger. What would you do then?
Called me and said, is it okay if we put your picture in the front of our book?
No. I'm talking about our panel.
Yeah.
What if our panel had said, your rights have been violated. Then what, I guess the question to all of you again would be, what would you do then?
Call Paul.
Paul and bring your checkbook.
And I would ask Elaine, you know, what she wanted to do, if she wanted to pull the book from circulation, if you wanted money damages, you know, or what. But I would want to research the First Amendment versus privacy issue a little more closely.
Okay. I was just curious because I was a little shocked to meet, to find out that this book would be made with my picture.
Yeah, that would be a shock.
So many years.
Hey, Elaine, thank you for the very good call. Appreciate it.
Okay, bye.
1-800-348-2551. And now, what are the chances of this happening? We're going to hear from Vivian from where? Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
Vivian in Vermont. The English majors would tell you that's alliteration. Let's go to Vivian. Vivian, you're on.
Hello. I'd like the answer to this following question. If you want to develop something from a literary work that's already in the public domain, treatment for a screenplay, for instance, how do you go about protecting your work? An example of this would be what Ivory Merchant did with screenplays or making movies out of Jane Austen books and so forth like that.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you go about doing it, and what organization do you apply to protect that kind of work?
It would be a copyright. You would go to the copyright office at copyright.gov. You would say that your new work is a derivative work of the public domain work, but everything new that you put into your adaptation would belong to you, and you could get copyright protection for that.
Okay, thank you. Have you put your information, people who are on the show doing answering our questions. Have you announced yet how we can get in touch with you if we want to?
No, but let's do that right now, okay? Go ahead, Paul, you start.
This is Paul.
Wait a second. Vivian, do you have your pen there?
I do.
Okay, go.
You can reach me at paul@paulrapp.com.
Spell your name, please.
Paul Rapp, R-A-P-P, as in Peter.
.com.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks so much.
This is Nagesh. You can just reach me at gnrxconsulting101@gmail.com. That's gnrxconsulting101@gmail.com. Or you can just Google, my name is so unique. There's not many people with my name. So if you Google Nagesh, N-A-G-E-S-H, last name Rao, R-A-O, you'll see my stuff pop up pretty quickly in the Google search.
Okay.
Thank
and
you.
Bill Westwood?
Thank you.
And you can email me at westwood@capital.net or see my website at billwestwood.com.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Vivian.
Thank you.
All right. Let's go to Gary in Massachusetts. Gary, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Yep.
So I have been working with a process, you know, this different career choice books out there, things like Do What You Want, The Money Will Follow, and then the old What Color Is Your Parachute, et cetera. And they all have different processes in there. And I've been working with a process that kind of takes some elements from those, but I developed a spreadsheet that takes those and other kinds of questions and ranks them, and is kind of neat, actually. I have never seen anything quite like it, although I haven't done a lot of research. My main question is that I've been really reluctant to share the intricate details with people because I think it may be relatively unique in terms of the way it's laid out and allows me to rank and score different questions and different elements to come up with some decision-making tools. And I also do some consulting for people, which sometimes includes things like this.
Okay, but Gary, only because we're running out of time.
Okay, so I think it's potentially marketable. I'm thinking about having a program, like a form-based program developed on this. Is that something I would need to patent, trademark, copyright? I mean, I'm just not even sure. I've never done anything should somebody say,
Gary, we get the point.
Two things. If it's the algorithm, it's probably copyrightable, but the actual methodology that you're doing, that's a business method or software method patent. If I were you, and I know what you're talking about, it's a search engine optimization kind of tool that you're playing with the rank scoring. It's kind of what Google does and a few of the other major search engines. There's also a thing backed by Brad Feld, the tech stars, called SEO Moz. It's the hot thing right now in the social web media 2.0, blah 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 crap. If I was you, I would take a look in Google Patents and take a look at the business method patents and do a search.
At this point doing a spreadsheet, just start looking at that level though.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. That falls under business method patents at the USPTO.
Is it business method? Okay, one last follow up question to that. How easy, it seems to me that all somebody would need to do to use this and make it their own is just change one little thing about it. Is that not, assuming that it's not, they don't steal the code, but they just the process?
that depends on how you decide to protect it based on the claim language. And this goes into a deep dive that we don't have the time for right now, but there are ways to protect yourself from a broad scope and also a narrow scope perspective.
And that's probably where branding comes in, and that would be a trademark issue. You want to give this a name that's memorable, and that's something that you can then trademark so that, you know, you're the first one, you're the authentic one, and everybody that comes after you will be a pretender. And so that's really a matter of marketing, branding, and trademark protection.
Gary, we got two more people. I want to give them a chance. Thanks a lot. Okay. Let's go to Dave in Pittsfield. Dave in Pittsfield, you're on.
Yes, good afternoon. I have a question in regards to, I have a good idea how to for an invention, but I don't have the knowledge to build it. Now, if I were to ask an engineer, electronics engineer, somebody that could do that, how would I protect myself and not have the engineer run off with my idea and make the patent on his own?
You would, Dave, this is Nagesh, you would have some sort of confidentiality disclosure agreement. non-disclosure agreement and a non-competes agreement sort of thing put together to basically have the any of the invention that's developed by the engineer under your management, the assignee rights of that technology would be forwarded over to you based on the contractual agreement you have with the person.
What's the assignee rights?
Assignee rights. So in the U.S. patent system, there's an inventor of the technology, but assignee means who is the owner of the technology.
Mm-hmm.
So,
oh, I see.
So my brother-in-law, for example, is one of the guys who invented the Pentium chip for Intel.
Really?
So he was behind the whole Pentium chip technology development. But the assignee of that technology that he invented was Intel. So Intel owned it. They gave him a plaque and $100 and said, good job for creating this technology that has made us billions of dollars. So assignee is the ownership of the patent.
And you can find simple non-disclosure agreements. Just Google non-disclosure agreement or NDA, and you can find some pretty good templates online.
And there's also a cool thing called Docracy, D-O-C-R-A-C-Y. I just discovered it recently, docracy.com or docracy.org. It's this awesome crowdsourcing platform where people share all sorts of legal documents and whatnot that you can use for all sorts of things. I've been exploring it. Also,
Docracy.o.
I'm going to send that to you, Paul. It is
thank
awesome.
You.
Sounds cool. Dave, that's all we got time for today.
Thank you very
much. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, bye.
That was really good. I mean, that was our money's worth right there for the whole show. Okay, let's go to Louise in Warwick, Massachusetts. Louise.
Hi.
Hey.
Hi. I have a very basic question. I have a son who's starting up a new company. What's the difference in cost between copyright and trademark?
Copyright is really cheap. It's
$35. It's about to go up to $45, but right now it's $35.
Is it going up to $45?
Well, that's what they're proposing. That's what they're pushing.
But it's still cheap. You know, a trademark, if you want to get a state trademark, it's cheap. It only covers the, you know, within the boundaries of a state, but that's typically about $50. But a federal trademark is considerably more expensive. It's around $300 for the filing fee, and you really should have an attorney do it because there's some nuances there that an attorney would know that you would have no idea about. And it's going to take an attorney an hour or two to do all of the research and to get the application in.
Louise, I'm so sorry, but we really are running out of time here. A real fast one. Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to, if it's the name of his company.
That's a trademark.
That's a trademark.
Yes.
Yep. So he'd have to go the trademark route. Okay.
Yes.
Thanks, Louise.
Thank you.
I am so sorry. We will not be able to take Morgan's call from Berlin. We're out of time. I want to thank everybody who called in. Let's see. Support for the Box Power comes from Tom Wall Photography, specializing in contemporary photojournalistic approach to weddings and portraits for the entire WMC listening area. TomWallPhotography.com and 20th Century Illumination, New Salem, Massachusetts, presenting Beyond Genocide, the traveling exhibition of contemporary illuminated manuscripts exploring the international legacy of genocide. 20th Century Illuminations.com and the Yiddish Book Center, Amherst, Massachusetts, presenting Yidstock, a festival of new Yiddish music featuring the Klezmatics, so-called Hankus Netsky, Frank London, and more. July 11th through the 15th, YiddishBookCenter.org, and the Sterling and Francine Clark Art Museum, Williamstown, Massachusetts, presenting Unearth, recent archaeological discoveries from Northern China, clarkart.edu. Thanks again, everybody, for joining us on the Vox Pop. Let me very quickly ask each of you to give your contact information one more time. Paul Rapp?
You can reach me through my website, which is paulrapp.com.
That's two P's in Rapp.
Two P's.
Okay. Natish?
You know, easiest way is to just Google Nagesh Rao. My LinkedIn profile pops up real fast.
Okay.
BillWestwood.com or westwood@capital.net.
Well, folks, our engineer has been Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by Melissa Wednesday Bunning. Our producer is Patrick Donges. I'm Alan Chartok. On tomorrow's program, it's Automotive Repair with Gordon Fricke and the incomparable and unequaled Raymond Graff. Stay tuned now after a little bit of music for the news update. Thank you.